You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between modern spirituality and formal religion? Given the number of Americans who currently define themselves as spiritual but not religious, it is clear that many people don't see religion as their only path to God. In fact, my guest today is convinced that a new era has begun in the way people understand and interact with God. Defining the earliest centuries of the Christian church as the age of faith and the 1500 years that followed as the age of belief, he sees the rise in the 21st century of something called the age of the spirit. Harvey Cox is Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. He writes about his observations and how they might affect our lives and our culture in his new book, The Future of Faith. Harvey, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. Glad to be here.
We'll start by saying that although the title is The Future of Faith, a lot of what you discuss centers on the Christian faith. Do you think, though, that this phenomenon of spirituality over religiosity is unique to Christianity?
Oh, not at all. No, I think what we're watching here is a change in the nature of religiousness that sweeps across all the various traditions, all of them. Around the world, and Christianity is a particularly striking example of it, but I don't think it's unique.
Interestingly, you point out the fact that we have seen a resurgence of religion in the modern world, which is something that very few observers would have predicted even a few decades ago.
Oh, that's true, yes. In fact, when I first started teaching, which was now 45 years ago, there were a lot of very thoughtful people who were predicting that religion was declining, it would become marginal, it would certainly have no more influence in the public realm of policy making, it wouldn't have much influence on culture, could probably be continued in small little enclaves or family rituals and little references here and there and in poetry and books and things, but it was on the decline because it was thought that modernization with technology and communications and literacy and so on would really mean the demise of religion. Now, you know, there have been a lot of mistaken predictions made throughout human history, but that was one of the most mistaken ones, perhaps, that's ever been made, because what happened in the ensuing decades after that was, in fact, a rather remarkable a resurgence of religion in virtually all the religious traditions around the world. And I have to say quickly, this is good news and bad news. Sometimes it's good for us, sometimes it's not. Often it's very mixed, but that is certainly what has been happening. So that prediction was totally off base, and I've witnessed that in my own teaching and writing career. However, what we do see is a remarkable change in what I call religiousness, that is, what it means to larger and larger numbers of people to think of themselves as a religious person, or increasingly, people would say, as a spiritual person, making a kind of a distinction that wasn't made in previous centuries between the two.
You outline essentially three epochs in religious life since the birth of Jesus: the age of faith, the age of belief, and now the age of spirit. Before we talk about those, we should discuss the distinction that you make between the meanings of the words faith and belief.
Yeah, that's pretty important. They are often confused or even identified in people's minds, but they are quite different. Belief really means giving assent to an idea or a proposition. I believe that this is true. I'm not sure, but I think I believe that. It suggests an opinion, perhaps a strong opinion. Whereas faith, which comes from the Latin word fides, means fidelity. It means loyalty. It means a basic kind of inner commitment at a quite personal level to somebody or something, which isn't just an opinion. It's something which really forms the way a person lives his or her life. So although the two are often confused, there is an important difference. And I think in order to understand what's happening in the religious world now around the globe, and including in Christianity, you have to see it as a movement more and more toward what is rightly considered to be faith, and not giving assent or subscribing to particular creedal or doctrinal ideas.
Yeah, you make the point that of all the major world religions, Christianity is the only one that really has a defined creed.
Well, yeah, others have something approaching it, or they have lots and lots of different things like that. But in fact, it's important to remember that for the first 300 years of its life, the most vigorous, in some ways the most vigorous part of the history of Christianity, there was not a creed. There was not a single creed. There was not a hierarchy. There was a wide variety of different formulations, different practices, different liturgies, different ways of being Christian around the Mediterranean basin where it was growing. And it wasn't until the Emperor Constantine in 325, the 4th century, who decided that he wanted to, in a sense, sort of take over Christianity to provide the empire that he saw as falling apart with some kind of unifying ideology. In other words, he wanted Christianity to be the ideology of the empire, and he wanted it to be very clear what it was, and so he brought the bishops together at this place called Nicaea, which was his summer palace, by the way, and fed them and wined them and dined them and said, now, let's formulate a creed. And his own advisor provided a pre-written creedal statement, and all the bishops were supposed to subscribe to it. And they all did. There were a few exceptions who were promptly sent out to the outer provinces and deprived of their living so that he could enforce a uniform and creedal and hierarchical expression of Christianity, but again, underlining as an imperial project to shore up the empire. Well, it didn't work, and they started quibbling right away about what the creed meant. They formulated other creeds. They began excommunicating each other, and within about four decades, the first Christian was executed by other Christians for his lack of theological correctness. This was part of the impact of what Constantine had done. So it was a very, very unfortunate turn of events, negative turn of events, I think, for Christianity. And that what I call Constantinian formula lasted for centuries and centuries. Now, not everybody was enveloped in it. I mean, there were lots and lots of people who weren't, but the official church throughout all those years was hierarchical, creedal, and concerned about the purity of these ideas that you were supposed to subscribe to. And it's that period that I argue or contend in my book has been coming to an end for the past decades and is really now the third kind of way, more like the first than the second, is coming into being.
Why do you think that age of belief, as you call it, or this time of sort of imperial Christianity lasted for so long? It looks to be 1,500 years or more.
Yeah, well, a lot of it was that during the medieval period and up into the early modern period, the church and the imperial structure and then later the early nationalist states were so intertwined that hierarchical and creedal understandings of Christianity could be enforced. I mean, heresy became treason, and treason was heresy. So you were skating on rather thin ice if you stepped outside the line, as many, many, many people did, who were then hunted down or burned as heretics or excommunicated or whatever. They were tried to run a very tight ship. Now, the fact that there were all these people who objected or just didn't subscribe to it suggests that it wasn't working well, but they certainly were enforcing it. Now, the other thing is that since it was mainly in Europe that Christianity was existing at the time, there was very little awareness that there were other religious alternatives, other ways of religiously understanding the world and the universe. It wasn't until the age of discovery that people began finding out about this and having to deal with the fact that the religion of Christianity was one among others. And for a long time, it continued to be mainly the Christianity of the continued to be the religion of the West. However, a very decisive change occurred about 50 years ago in Christianity, in which it stopped being a largely Western religion. Now, many people don't know this, Chris, but the majority of Christians around the world no longer live in Europe and the United States. They're in Africa. They're in Asia, increasingly now in China, in India. The majority now are not in the old precinct of European Christendom. And therefore, dealing with the pluralism, the irreducible pluralism of religion, has become an absolute necessity for Christianity. And I think one of the elements in the rise of what I call spirituality is that Christians who live throughout their lives and every day of their lives as minorities in countries with and regions with many other religions understand that, whereas those who live mainly or used to live mainly in areas where that wasn't part of their awareness didn't have to.
Yeah, I guess there's got to be a fundamental difference between people who are born into a particular system of beliefs as opposed to those who embrace it sort of on their own and have chosen it.
Yeah, that is. That's an important difference.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Harvey Cox. His new book is called The Future of Faith. Can you talk for a minute about the fact that, on a personal note, your own sort of spiritual journey mirrors the three ages that you've identified in the book?
Yeah, well, I know I'm talking to an interviewer from Dallas, and I hope that there are a few Baptists tuned in, because I was born and raised in an evangelical Baptist church in southern Pennsylvania, and throughout my childhood, youth, young manhood, as far as I was concerned, being a Christian meant following Jesus. That was what we were taught. There and also that there aren't, Baptists don't have creeds. We certainly don't have hierarchies. So it wasn't until later on that I discovered there were such things when I met people who belonged to churches who were like that. So my earliest stage was a little bit like the early stage of Christianity, I think. I don't want to be pretentious about this, but I think it was. And then I went into college and became, I guess, more aware of the history and extent of Christianity, and went through a phase, not a very long phase, but it was certainly not 1,500 years, in which I was really attracted to a more quasi-fundamentalist version of Christianity.
Let's make this a little cliffhanger, and we'll come to the rest of this after the break. Harvey Cox is my guest. He's Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. His new book is called The Future of Faith. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University, Harvey Cox. His new book is called The Future of Faith. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Harvey, you were telling us that you sort of got to university and decided that you wanted to explore some other aspects of your faith and found yourself temporarily in a sort of personal age of belief.
I did. That's right. And I look back on that as a period in which I really felt very secure in that kind of doctrinal scaffolding and that understanding of Christian life. But it became much more difficult to sustain as I met people, other Christians who didn't share that particular dogmatic or doctrinal set of beliefs that I was attached to, and then people in other religions and so on. So I had to make some provision for what I would think was a maturation into what became for me either a new age of faith or an age of the Spirit. I later began calling it age of the Spirit. But, you know, I look back on that period when I felt that kind of personal security in a Christian student group that I was part of at University of Pennsylvania, not with regrets or not with any kind of resentment. I mean, I understand, I think, what people are looking for and why they turn to that particular understanding of Christianity. I learned something during that period. I didn't actually stay with it, but I retained friends in that group, and when I moved on to something else. So in my book, The Future of Faith, I don't try to disparage the age of belief or theologically conservative Christianity at all. That's part of that went into making me who I am, and I think I would be the poorer if it weren't for it. But I did move on to another phase.
Do you think it's the same way for sort of the history of Christianity in general, that it is the better for having been through that period, that age of belief?
Well, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, you know. I mean, that was then, this is now. I mean, this is the age of belief did produce Chartres Cathedral and Dante's Divine Comedy and some of the great thinkers and saints, St. Francis and of Assisi and St. Teresa and all the rest. It also produced
the Crusades,
goodness, the Crusades and the Inquisitions and the Torquemadas. It's hard to make an overall judgment about it. But it's still with us in many ways. I mean, we don't want to dismantle the cathedrals, for heaven's sake, or the great historical liturgies of the church or things like that. We have to understand them in a new way, I think, as part of the history which has brought us where we are, and therefore as a prompt to be able to move on, as our ancestors did, into a new way of understanding our faith for this kind of new world that we live in.
You do believe, Harvey, firmly that fundamentalism is dying. Can you tell us what signs you see?
Yeah, I think it is. It remains, of course, very evident and sometimes rather noisy. But it is declining. The American religious right, for example, seems now to have virtually disappeared from the scene. They just have not been able to organize or produce or turn out the support of the votes that they used to claim they could. More and more young evangelical people in American Christian colleges, evangelical colleges, are broadening out their social agenda. They're not just interested in the old narrow issues, but they're interested in peacemaking. They're interested in world hunger and climate change and things like that. That whole population is changing rapidly. And the attitude even of evangelical Christians, I would say even especially of evangelical Christians, toward other faiths and what the relationship of Christianity should be to other faiths is undergoing a very remarkable change. There's more dialogue and exchange now going on, let's say between Christians and Muslims, or Christians and Buddhists, and so on, than any time in previous history. And it's interesting to me that it is often evangelicals who are leading in this effort, and their predecessors of a couple, two or three generations ago would not have been doing that. So the fundamentalist definition within Christianity is certainly declining, and we've just been reading recently about the steep falling off in Islamic countries of support for Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and so on. People are just getting fed up with the fact that those folks can do a lot of killing and damaging of their fellow Muslims, but they haven't produced health care or employment or food, and so they're backing off from them. So it just seems to me that wherever you look, what we call, sometimes using it very broadly, the term fundamentalism, is in decline. And it's one of the reasons is, Chris, I think it's very hard to maintain the kind of exclusivist view of religion, of spirituality, that my way is the only way, when we are confronted every day, more and more in a pluralistic America, in a pluralistic world, with other people, with other ways of understanding reality, and we have to relate to them and live with them. It takes an awful lot of energy to maintain that my way only point of view, and people eventually, I think, just modify that in one way or another.
What do you say, Harvey, to people who would perhaps acknowledge that we are entering something like the age of the spirit that you've described here, but worry that this is sort of starting us down the path to a kind of anything goes moral relativism?
Yeah, well, I think there is a valid objection there. I think the stage that this emergent spirituality is in now is often quite fuzzy and often not sufficiently grounded in some kind of transcendent mystery that really has to ground us all. It's also sometimes very individualistic, like you can do this sort of on your own. But I think what we are seeing is a form, as a way of understanding and living. Let's talk about Christianity here for a moment. The Christian faith, which is strikingly similar to the earliest Christians, more than, say, the medieval Christians, and in which the institutional and theological understanding of the faith was just emerging and will emerge now. I think we'll have a clear institutional way of doing things together with this rather new and yet very old understanding of Christianity, and we'll have ways of formulating it intellectually, but we're not there yet, and therefore I think some of that objection maybe is correct, although a little premature.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Harvey Cox is with us. His new book is called The Future of Faith. Let's go to Patrick in Richardson. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. I just want to say, once again, an excellent show.
Thank you.
Listen, I wanted to bring up, I read a wonderful essay called On Ontology by Aleister Crowley. Now, leaving everything that's subjective about Aleister Crowley out of this, he postulated that one has to decide whether God is either finite or infinite. And the way he did this is he put it into a mathematical function where the function of God, or everything that is God, and this, you know, the higher purpose, is made up of either, you know, the way that it's laid out in traditional Christianity is a combination of the good works of humans, the good works of angels, and then the bad works of Satan. But if you, at the beginning of that, if you decide that God is infinite, based upon the mathematical equation on the left-hand side of the function, that means that everything from Satan, humans, and the angels are irrelevant because the infinity is on the left-hand side of the equation. So people who follow Christianity, do they all have to believe that God is finite to make all this work, so to speak, in the dogma of Christianity? And I guess that would also apply to Islam, too. Once again, you have a great show, and I'll take my question up there.
Thanks for your call.
Wow, boy, that's an expedition into a territory I haven't been in much, this caller. The application of math to theology. I think I have to think about that more. The traditional answer in Christian theology, of course, is that God is infinite, although not unchanging. And we try to wrap our minds around that. God is more of a process than an entity, but certainly infinite, and therefore, we have to be very careful that we don't identify our ideas about God, our doctrines about God, with the reality of God. One of the most serious dangers in any religion, Christianity, Islam, or any of them, is the confusion of our human efforts to symbolize and describe God with God's self, which is far beyond our poor powers to describe, although we have to keep trying. We are thinking beings, and we use language and symbols. We will continue to do so. But I remember a very important explanation of the commandment: "Do not make any graven images of God." So this isn't really about God so much as it is about our incapacity to make any kind of an image that would do justice to what we're trying to describe. So I guess I vote for the infinite with all of that subtext explanation there. That was a really intriguing question.
Not the wrath of God, but the math of God.
The math of God. Let's go with that. Yeah, Chris, that's good.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bedford, and we'll speak to Weston. Hey, Weston.
Hi. It's a great show, by the way. I love this program. But I had a question. I've noticed just through my interactions with people and my friends and everything that I sort of see the evolution of religion going like one of two ways. Like one would be towards the absence of religion, like more towards atheism. And then the other one I've noticed is people, like, for example, one of my friends, she labels God as Lola as opposed to God. It's sort of what she makes it. And it's sort of independent of any sort of fundamental idea or organized idea of religion. And I was just wondering if, you know, you had seen anything like this or this made any sense. I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, you know, I spend my days and months and years and have for a very long time with students, many of them undergraduates. I do a lot of my teaching of Harvard undergraduates. And so I watch these tendencies as they come and go, and he's asking about what I observe, I guess mainly among young people. He sounds to be like a young guy who's talking about his friends. What I see is a very, very deep inquisitiveness, almost a yearning on the part of lots and lots of students and other young people for some way of understanding the sacred, the great mystery that surrounds us, call it God if you will, without necessarily accepting all the scaffolding, the doctrinal and institutional scaffolding with which it has been delivered to us, so to speak. People really want to experience it on their own. I mean, that's a very important thing that's happening. We used to call it mysticism. The direct experience of God, and with only a very few people who were gifted with that capacity, or some people spending months and months in the desert in monasteries. Now it seems to be far, far more widely spread, much more democratic. And I think it's a positive trend. I wish that the churches could pick up on this more than they have, and help people think through how they're going to formulate and describe and act on their convictions, rather than just kind of floundering around on their own, which many people are. But I think it's helpful. It's a hopeful sign, at least that I see in my students. It isn't just intellectual curiosity. It's really wanting to explore what the spiritual options are and where they should move. And they often put together things from different traditions and don't buy the whole package of a single one. And that seems to me okay, too.
You know, another really interesting phenomenon that you write about here is the idea that for a long time in Christian tradition, being a good Christian had a lot to do with sort of earning your place in heaven or avoiding, eternal damnation. And today you see that many people's focus in terms of the way they conduct themselves is about improving this world that we live in right now, as opposed to being focused on what happens after the moment of death.
Yeah, that's true. And that's very remarkable change. Think about Jonathan Edwards, the great New England preacher, you know, who preached that fabulous classic sermon of telling people they were like a spider being hung over a raging fire, and he preached a lot about hell and damnation, and it wasn't too long ago. When I was a kid, I heard some of that too. But believe me, I get around to a lot of churches, Pentecostal churches, evangelical churches. And a lot of it now, most of it, is how do I live my life here? How do I live my life as a faithful Christian here today? Much less emphasis on what happens next.
Harvey Cox is with us. He's Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard. His new book is called The Future of Faith. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Harvey Cox, who is Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. His new book is called The Future of Faith. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You know, Harvey, there remains a great deal of hand-wringing over what many people perceive to be the conflict between science and faith. Your observation, though, and this is something that I think a lot of people might be able to relate to, is that the progress we're making in science has the potential, in fact, to make us more spiritual as we start to understand the remarkable workings of the universe.
Yeah, that's true. I'm now part of a science and religion study seminar here with scientists and theologians, religion scholars, and it's a remarkable and very welcoming, exciting new frontier. A lot of the old confrontation and battles of maybe a century ago or even 50 years ago seem to be over. And in my view, science has done two very important things that work to the favor of a religious view of the world. One is they have made more general the idea that many people now hold to, that you don't accept a proposition about anything simply on somebody else's authority. You have to have evidence. You have to experience it yourself, and therefore, a religion based on hierarchical authority that you simply stand at attention and obey, or say yes, or subscribe, is no longer plausible to more and more people. And I think, again, this goes back to the earliest years of Christianity, when the encounter of the earliest disciples with Jesus, and then the encounter of those who came afterwards with the resurrected, the spirit of Jesus, was what was important, and not ideas about him. That's one thing. The second thing is that the pell-mell pace of science and technology has raised questions about the meaning of life, the meaning, the significance of death and dying, the fabric of the whole universe, and the continuing evolution of the cosmos. All these kinds of questions, which elude the present state of the scientific method, and which hark back to many of the ideas that we have inherited from the religious traditions of the world. So I find my scientific colleagues here at this university just enormously more interested and more sympathetic to conversations with and learning back and forth between science and religion than they've ever been. I think it's a very promising period.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ryan in Richardson. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. This is a good show you're having. I wanted to go back in reference to what the professor had said in regards to the first questionnaire who called in about in reference to our idea or description of God and how it is limited because it's finite. And whereas God, we have to be careful with the anthropomorphism of ascribing our things and ideas and attributes to God because God is infinite. And he said he chose the infinite. And if that's the case, with God being infinite, wouldn't that contradict the concept of Jesus being the incarnation of God or Jesus being the Son of God? Wouldn't that fall into the anthropomorphic dangers that he was saying we have to be careful of? I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Ryan. And maybe, Harvey, as you're answering this, you can also talk a little bit about new Christians in this age of the Spirit and their views on the divinity of Jesus.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a very thoughtful question. And there's a caller that I would love to have a long conversation with. The way I like to put this is that God is infinite, but all of God that could possibly be contained in one human being, I say this as a Christian, I understand, and please understand that, was there in Jesus of Nazareth. And so we call him the Son of God, the Messenger of God, the Prophet of God, the light of God. There are a lot of different ways that he has been referred to as that point in human history to which we look and refer if we want to know what God is like. It's a very simple thing. God is like Jesus, and Jesus is like God. We have said, however, throughout Christian history, that they are not the same. There is the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. The relationship has always been hard to define and rather mysterious, but nonetheless, that's what we talk about. Now, the fact that when we try to talk about or describe God, we necessarily use anthropomorphic terms or human terms is inescapable. Of course we will. That's who we are. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We continue doing it. We continue to recognize that these are limited formulations. They're correctable, and we're open to have them corrected, but we have to continue doing that, and will continue doing it. So we have all of these metaphors for God. God is as light. God is as ultimate being. God is as a raging fountain or a mountain. All these metaphors that we use, and we'll always do that. But again, recognizing that it's a human vocabulary.
We have an email here from Kevin in Plano who writes, my father, who received a Master's of Theology from Harvard in 72, always talks about the context in which the Bible was written. I have found that this makes faith seem less important, placing more emphasis on the academic. Will you talk about how the two intertwine for you?
Oh, I think the context of the Bible is very important. You have to realize that, for example, when St. Paul is writing his letters, he's writing them to a particular congregation in Ephesus or in Corinth or in Rome, where they had particular issues, both moral issues and theological issues, some of which are similar to ours today, some of which are not. We can learn from them, but they were very, very contextually directed. And you might ask, I mean, students ask me this, why do we have four different Gospels? Why wasn't one good enough to, I mean, it's only one person they're talking about there, one central figure. Why four? And we might even say, why five, since we now know there was another gospel that's just been dug up in the last years, the Gospel of Thomas. Well, the reason is context, is that the writers, Matthew and Mark and Luke and John and so on, were writing to a specific area where people had their cultural presuppositions, they had their ideas, and he wanted to relate the story of Jesus and the central core of the message of Jesus, the gospel, to the context to which he was writing. So I do think, and I don't think for a minute that this deprives or undercuts the reality of faith. It makes it even more important. I mean, I'm in a context too, and we're all in a context, and therefore, to be contextual, if you will, about our understanding makes it more living and less rigid, less static.
Recognizing that this calls for a broad generalization, how well do you think Christian churches and denominations in existence right now that have been around for some time are coping with the transition of their membership to more of an age of the Spirit?
Yeah, that is a very broad question, and of course the answer is some are doing better than others. In general, I think that in many ways the people in the pews, in their instinctive spiritual yearnings and the way they move and the way they think, can be often ahead of the clergy. Now, I say that taking some responsibility, since I've been involved in training ministers, among other things, for a very long time. But a lot of what we teach in seminaries has to do with Christian theology, Christian thought, Christian philosophy, and we haven't really adequately prepared a lot of the ministers, and I think it's also true of priests and rabbis, to understand and help people with the actual experience of God. That's something else. Now, some are doing that better than others. I don't want to generalize here. And so there are many, many clergy people who are doing a wonderful job at that. But I think we're behind the curve, and we need to do it better.
I wonder about the challenge for people who are leading congregations in dealing with the questions of doubt that arise when you sort of detach yourself a little bit from this required system of beliefs. It makes it harder, doesn't it, for them to help their flocks sort of hang on to what they believe?
Well, doubt can arise anywhere. It arises very, very much within the minds of people who are part of a system, of a rigid system of beliefs. I have only to mention Mother Teresa, who in her wonderful letters that were published after her death, she is a faithful, active, lifelong Roman Catholic, a nun, confessing that many, many times she's gone through long periods of severe doubt. But she continued to live what she believed was the Christian faith, even when she had doubts about even the reality of God at times, or some of the doctrines about God. So I don't at all believe that understanding Christianity is a matter of faith and the way you live your life primarily and not primarily as a list of beliefs that you have to adhere to is negative or prompts any kind of diminution of Christian life. In fact, I think it enhances it.
Let's go next on the phones to Letitia in Dallas. Hey, Letitia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You mentioned a while ago about the evolution of the cosmos, and obviously we're evolving all the time. I wonder why the churches and religious institutions have not evolved just like the cosmos has, because faith is an ever-evolving thing. From my point of view, I grew up Catholic. I left it in my 20s because of the dogma and the contradictions. And then I went to a New Thought church and stayed there for a long time and loved it. And now I'm more, I left that church as well. Now I'm more of a philosophy that I go within to find that experience of God that you talked about. And and what I'm doing now is a lot more individual. It's following my intuition, which I truly believe is that God presence speaking to me through me. And so following my intuition is more where I've evolved to. And I just wonder why the institutions haven't evolved in that way.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I asked myself the same question, believe me. But maybe the good news is that they are evolving. Maybe not as quickly as you or I would like to see them evolve, but religious institutions are changing. And they're changing, I think, most rapidly in areas of the world, as I mentioned before on this program, are in other parts of the world, in Asia and Latin America and Africa and so on. Not as quickly here, where the patterns are more rigid and the doctrinal structure has been placed more firmly. I think in other places it's not that firmly fixed. So they are evolving, and in a sense, my whole book, The Future of Faith, is about how religion is now changing, how it's evolving. Again, perhaps not as quickly as we'd like, but it is certainly evolving. And you know, if it doesn't evolve, if it doesn't change, it eventually just petrifies and it's gone. All life changes. Human life, cosmic life, religious life, and if it doesn't, it's dead.
Harvey Cox is Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. His new book is called The Future of Faith. Harvey, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, you're welcome, and hello to everybody down there in Texas.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Pathways of emigration are well trodden, and emigrant songs have long been a part of the traditional singer's repertoire. Hear the music of emigration from the Highlands and Islands of Scotland in emotion-filled songs and tunes, old and new, this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Saturday night at 9 on KERA 90.1.
It's 12:59. You're listening to your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. In Tyler, it's K261 CW 100.1. We're at K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman.
Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, one man's obsessive quest to the edge of extinction. We'll talk to biologist and writer Glenn Chilton, who traveled 82,000 miles, that's more than three times around the globe, in order to track down every preserved specimen of the Labrador duck, the first bird native to North America known to have gone extinct following the arrival of European settlers. We'll talk to Chilton about what is known about the duck today, what might have led to its demise, and how he learned that every single purported Labrador egg on the planet is actually a fake. Our conversation begins after the news from National Public Radio.